From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, on the eve of the opening of Captain Marvel, we talk about movie review websites and the trolls who have it in for films that star women. Then, how do you begin the process of cutting down hundreds of hours of pristine, never-before-seen footage of the Apollo 11 mission?
There is a 9-day version of the film that exists. We tried to get every available piece that we could and lay it out in a timeline so we could see what we got.
And an LA-based singer draws inspiration from Catholic saints, cumbia, and queer punk. All that coming up today on The Frame. Captain Marvel opens this weekend, and with its release, Marvel Studios finally will have a superhero story led by a woman, actress Brie Larson.
I keep having these memories. I see flashes. I think I have a life here. Can't tell if it's real.
The fact that any woman is starring in a big action movie was not welcome news to a variety of internet trolls and misogynists. They also attack Larson for reaching out to film journalists who are not white men, who account for the vast majority of people in those jobs. Some of the negative online comments about Captain Marvel were so pervasive that the movie review aggregation site Rotten Tomatoes took down user opinions of the film, which were posted well before the general public even could have seen the movie. The entire episode revived questions about trolling against high-profile movies that are anchored by women. Miranda Bailey is a movie producer. She's also the founder of the website Cherry Picks. It's devoted to movie reviews written by female critics. When we spoke earlier today, I asked Bailey if the online backlash against Captain Marvel is a throwback to attacks on other female-led films.
Obviously, trolls exist. Ghostbusters with Kristen Wiig and Leslie Jones, we experienced a big kind of troll backlash with that. And I mean, I love the movie. I think a lot of women love the movie and a lot of men were very angry about it, particularly like, you know, men who are going to that kind of term of fanboys. I assume that Captain Marvel had probably a lot of those kind of cranky troll people. I don't really understand those people, so I don't know.
Trolls are people who are kind of saying bad things about a movie before it opens, obviously are coming at a movie from a perspective where they don't have any information, and they may be motivated by things that we don't really understand or condone. But when a movie does open, the audience reaction to that film is more important than the critical reaction. That's what gets people coming back or checking out a movie, is word of mouth. So if you discount the voices of trolls, it is important, isn't it, what the audience ultimately thinks of any given movie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, word of mouth is super important. I mean, particularly in indie films. So with Captain Marvel, I think Captain Marvel already has a lot of word of mouth, even just us talking about this right here, that user ratings are not being allowed yet. I'm excited to see what the user score is. And if it will only be trolls using the user comments, or will actual fans come in and join the conversation and get it where it needs to be.
One of the things that also has happened is Brie Larson, the star of Captain Marvel, has been very specific in the people that she's been talking to. And when she's talking to people about this film, that she wants to make sure she's talking to a spectrum of film journalists, not just a bunch of straight white men. Why is that important? And do you think that's actually been part of the backlash against the film?
I think it's super important, and I'm so proud of her, and I think she's amazing, and it takes a lot of guts to kind of stand up and say that, especially, you know, when you're an actress and you're doing whatever the studio wants you to do for publicity, to say, hey, I want to make sure that I'm meeting with people of color and women. That is great, because we have a real problem, which is also why Cherry Picks started, in terms of allowing those voices through. She made a very specific statement saying, like, I want to have those critics be able to get into the movies. And, you know, now that I've gotten to know a lot of critics and a lot of women of color critics, they do have a very hard time getting passes into those movies, getting press on the carpet, getting, you know, into special screenings for film festivals and whatnot. So I think it was really important what Brie did.
And I think it's fair to say that generally a female critic will have different ways of looking at a film than a male critic. They may not be radically different. They may agree on certain things, but there's certainly difference in perspective and background. It could be your gender. It could be your race. It could be your sexual orientation. So do you think that when you have a diverse pool of critics, the nature of the criticism itself becomes more diverse and more representative of the way different people look and appreciate a film.
I do. Absolutely. I mean, I think every individual has their own point of view. I tend to like reviews that are a little kinder, personally, as a reader. You know, I don't want to like broad stroke it, but I've noticed that not that many female critics are as aggressively angry, necessarily, I would say, about the artistic parts of the film. I know that negative reviews, whether they are user comments or actual certified critics, can affect the way a film is opened and opening with the Rotten Tomatoes score, because we have become a society that, instead of really kind of reading all of the critic reviews or whatnot, the general population, people who are not in the industry, will just look and see, does it have a tomato or does it have a splat?
So DC and Warner Brothers made Wonder Woman. Now Marvel and Disney have made Captain Marvel, and it's co-directed by a woman, Anna Boden, who directed it with Ryan Fleck. It stars Brie Larson in the lead role. It's Marvel's first movie with a female hero at the top of the story. How important is that in how far Marvel has come and maybe how far Hollywood still has to go?
I think it's super important and really exciting. I'm very excited to take my daughter to it. Like you mentioned, Wonder Woman. I think Wonder Woman surprised the industry, and I think all of us were kind of hoping that it would be good, and Patty Jenkins made it freaking amazing and awesome. And you can tell by the deal that she had on her first film and then from the deal that she got on her second that the industry wasn't so sure it would do well, and it totally blew them out of the water. And I'm hoping that Captain Marvel does the same thing. But it's exciting. I mean, one thing I love about Marvel movies, which I'm hoping this one does as well, is, you know, they're pretty fun. Like the Guardians of the Galaxies of it all, like they're pretty, you know, witty and funky. So I'm hoping that Captain Marvel kind of has that as well. But again, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm definitely taking my daughter.
Randa Bailey is a producer. She's the founder of the review site Cherry Picks. Randa, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
John, thank you so much for having me.
You can find Bailey's website at thecherrypicks.com. And before we take a short break, let me remind you that The Frame is also a daily podcast. Subscribe and you won't miss a single episode of the show. You can find The Frame on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast source. Coming up, a new documentary revisits the Apollo moon landing through never-before-seen footage.
You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Oh my God, the car is sliding!
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, The Rock won't save you. Want to know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the historic Apollo 11 moon landing. Whether you watched the coverage live or only saw it years later, the new documentary Apollo 11 will be something you've never seen before. And that's because it's largely assembled from previously unseen footage and unheard audio. Late in 2016, director Todd Douglas Miller and his team set out to review all of the available footage of the Apollo 11 mission. They work with NASA and the National Archives, and then came a big discovery. Here's Todd Douglas Miller.
Probably about 3 or 4 months into it, our archive producer, Steven Slater, and a couple other folks were working with some of the research team at National Archives and had come across in May of 2017 some reels. And, you know, they didn't say exactly what was on them. They were labeled Apollo 11. Some had the dates of the launch, which was July 16th, 1969 on them. But we didn't know outside of just opening the reels and seeing the quality, we didn't know what was on them or really what the real quality of the imagery was. So one of the supervisory archivists at National Archives trooped two reels up to our facility in Manhattan. We put them on the scanner, and needless to say, our jaws were just absolutely on the floor.
This is the 65-millimeter footage, right? It's almost as big as an IMAX frame now.
That's correct. So it's commonly referred to as 65-millimeter 5-perf, and it predates IMAX, you know, by good almost 20 years. But what was equally exciting was the condition that everything was in. They were absolutely pristine reels, and it just wasn't these two. There were hundreds of them. We contracted with National Archives to digitize these materials, and then also with some other NASA facilities on some other flavors of large format, commonly referred to as 70 millimeter. But suffice it to say, that was one part of it.
Yeah, you're just talking about the visuals. There's also 11,000 hours of audio recordings. Is that right?
That's correct. So we were given access to, it was actually 18,000 hours of Apollo Air mission control audio. 11,000 hours, as you said, were directly related to Apollo 11. Completely uncatalogued. It was digitized by a team at the University of Texas, Austin, for a speech recognition project, but they had definitely didn't have any intention of using it in any form of media. So it was really the work of one individual in particular, Ben Feist up in Toronto, and a couple other people who were not approaching it as an audio problem, but more of as a technology problem. How do we sync all of this up? And how do we clean it all up and basically prepare it before the audio guys even touch it? And it's it was an immense operation, to say the least. As I've told people before, who have asked about how do you start editing, there is a 9-day version of the film that exists.
A little longer than most films.
Yeah, just a little bit longer, but we tried to get every available piece, every single frame, every single audio clip that we could, and lay it out in a timeline so we could see what we got.
Now 5 minutes, 52 seconds, and counting.
Booster flight.
CPSS, verify go for launch.
CPSS, verify go for launch.
CTSC, verify go for launch.
You made a decision very early on about the nature of the story, and that was going to be there wasn't going to be talking heads. There weren't going to be people explaining what was happening at any given moment. The footage and the audio would more or less speak for itself. Why was that decision important, and how did it dictate what you were and were not going to use?
Yeah, it was always the plan from the start, even before the large format came out. If you were around during the missions, you listened to them, they had a wonderful quote-unquote narrator in the public affairs officer. It was interchangeable. There was anywhere from 4 to 5 in each mission. He sat in mission control right next to all the other flight controllers back behind the flight director, and basically distilled down all the technical jargon that was being said on the air-to-ground transmissions between the astronauts and mission control.
We have some 7.6 million pounds of thrust pushing the vehicle upward, a vehicle that weighs close to 6.5 million pounds.
Every time I heard those guys, I just thought that they would it'd be a wonderful use of kind of being in the moment narration. So it was always the intention to just let the visuals speak for themselves.
We're talking with Todd Douglas Miller about his film Apollo 11. You also make a thematic choice to talk about process and not about heroes. And that is about the people who are behind the scenes. There's a sequence toward the end of the film where one of the astronauts is thanking the people who actually built the spacecraft. Why was that important?
Well, I think you can't tell the story of Apollo 11 or any of the other Apollo missions and the overall program without doing the research of who these people were, who did this. And the minute you ask that question, you're immediately exposed to numbers. Hundreds of thousands of people spread across tens of thousands of companies. And it always just struck me. And then to see footage of the workers, footage of not only mission control and the firing room, people that built the spacecraft, people that built the machinery to transport the spacecraft. One thing that was never lost on me in any of the footage was how young the mission controllers were, how young all the people were. I think there's a misunderstood theme with that era. Just because it was 50 years old, it was these, you know, older people that were working on it. Not so. Most of those flight controllers were in their 20s. The astronauts themselves were in their late 30s. They were the veterans. People looked up to them. In fact, the flight controller who was responsible for the abort or not aborting the landing when alarms were going off was a 24-year-old flight engineer named Jack Garman, who was sitting in a back room.
I'm going to play a piece of music. It's a song by John Stewart called Mother Country.
Oh, Mother Country, I do love you. Oh, Mother Country, I do love you.
It's probably not a song that a lot of people know about, but it plays a central role in the astronauts' return to Earth. How does it figure into the story, and how did you hear about it?
Well, when we first got the audio, not only this, 11,000 hours, but we also had the onboard, the air to ground, and on one of the onboard tracks, my producing partner, Tom Peterson, actually found this. We kind of had a divide and conquer approach. We had so much audio. We were enlisting everyone. Didn't matter if you were an audio engineer or not. You were going to listen to, hours and hours of footage. And Tom was just walking to work one day listening to, the onboard audio. He's played it for me a million times. I've played it myself another million. I still can barely make out that song. But sure enough, shortly before the guys went to bed, Buzz, just like in the movie, says, "Hey, you guys want to hear a piece of, want to play some music?" And about three or four songs in was this amazing track by this folk artist, John Stewart. He has since passed away, but his wife, Buffy Ford Stewart, we tracked her down, and she's a phenomenal musician in her own right. She told us she was floored. They never had heard this. John didn't know about it. They were friends of all these astronauts. John himself wrote a song. He was so inspired by Apollo 11. He wrote a song called Armstrong, wrote another one called Walk on the Moon. So it's it was a real honor to present his music for the first time in the film.
When you think of certain sequences that the public has never seen before, are there a couple you would single out as a new perspective into something that you thought you knew or you'd never seen before?
Yeah, one thing, it was, really the honor of my life to work with the astronauts and their families. I just read, so much their autobiographies and seen all the films. And one book in particular, Michael Collins's 1974 autobiography called Carrying the Fire, always made a big impression on me. He talks about several things that happened in the mission, and this was echoed by even Neil Armstrong in a recent interview for the 40th anniversary. He was asked what his most idyllic moment from the mission was, and it wasn't stepping foot on the moon, and it wasn't even coming home safely or landing on the moon. It was about 100,000 miles out on the way out to the moon. They saw a solar corona around the moon. There was an eclipse happening, and it just kind of made the moon look 3D-ish. And, on Apollo 11, it wasn't really their job to document. They didn't shoot a whole lot of film. Even though they took over 1,000 photographs, that wasn't very much as compared with the other Apollo missions. But we did find a piece of archive from another Apollo mission where an eclipse had happened. And we showed that to Buzz and to Mike. And we said, is this what it looked like? Is this, it was a little bit, we were a little bit further out. But yeah, that's, that was it. And so we go back, we'd work on it a little bit. Zooming it out, not adding anything to it. And that's it. That's perfect. To have that kind of validation to represent that sense of accuracy of, you were there and this is what it looked like as it happened was something I'll never forget. And I think adds a lot to the authenticity of the film.
Todd Douglas Miller is the director of Apollo 11. Todd, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Apollo 11 is playing now in select cities. It opens everywhere this Friday, and if you can, see it in an IMAX theater. Coming up on The Frame, LA singer San Cha puts a goth spin on cumbia. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. LA-based singer San Cha has had a complicated relationship with religion. Growing up Catholic in San Jose, her experiences singing in church were at odds with her queer identity. Later, she found her community in the Bay Area punk scene. Capricho del Diablo, or The Devil's Whim, is her latest album. The music is a do-it-yourself take on cumbia rhythms mixed with church harmonies and ranchera melodies. Her lyrics are personal stories interwoven with Catholic symbolism.
Hi, my name is Sancha. I'm a singer, I'm a songwriter, and a performer. I started singing in the church choir when I was 12. The music that I liked the most was always like this Lent season music that was very about like desperation, like I have no hope. Like I don't know where I'm going because I'm about to die kind of thing. But my life really changed when I met my drag mother in San Francisco. I met her at a bar, and we just danced all night. And then my drag mother, her name is Persia, she asked me to sing at her art opening. And since then, I've been performing like every weekend. The name Sancha, it means mistress, but I was thinking about, you know, like more in religious terms, where like a saint, San Francisco, San Jose, is kind of a side piece, and it kind of shows how polytheistic the Catholic Mexican religion is. So this album was a reflection on religion, on not having religion, on what spirituality looks outside of anything even written, and something more felt. Me Demandó is actually the first song that I wrote for the album. But I also, at that time, was singing on the streets in Mexico City, and how I, at times, would have to project to, like, big restaurants or even to places like taco stands that were all outside. And I was thinking of how free I felt when, like, I was at those, like, really high belty noises and how, like, liberating that felt. And it's mostly because of the freedom that I felt at that time, like being really distraught and hurt and being like, no, I'm going to take this energy and create something else that channels my hurt and my pain. Me demandó mi salvador means my savior sued me. So this song is specifically about this relationship that I had with somebody that was very like mentor, and about him telling me that, you know, I'm the special thing, but it's like something he wanted to consume and for his consumption. And once it didn't fit into that, then he wanted to sue me. He was like, you owe me your soul. And I worked a party for him. It's very like goth themed and very like S&M. So when he told me that, I was like, oh, he really thinks he's the devil. And for me, like, playing around with this devil and savior theme has switched back and forth, especially on this album. In the way, like, I've heard Chavela Vargas sing or Lola Beltran, you almost hear them crying on every track. I did go to Mexico. I kind of ran away. But I ended up landing in the farm that my mom grew up with. So I have an aunt that lives there. My mom is one of 12 children. And so the aunt that's living there is the one aunt that did not get married or did not cross the border to come to the United States. So I landed with her in this family farm. You know, I'm here coming from this queer scene and coming here with like purple hair, shaved eyebrows, long black dresses. And my aunt here, like as soon as I land, she's like, oh, I'm following the Virgen around to different farms. And they were praying like 3 to 4 rosaries every night and then having a service at every farm. And I'm over here like looking like the craziest witch lady alien that these kids have ever seen, you know? We're like, oh, these people in like rural whatever, they don't understand me. I'm queer and I'm this and that. And like, we actually had really beautiful conversations about a lot of things. And I opened up to her a lot and she opened up to me a lot. I was like my aunt who lives in rural wherever the you know, is way more compassionate than a lot of queer people that I've dealt with in places that are supposed to be woke.
Thank you, everybody, for being here tonight. Dicen que por las noches
no más se le iba. In LA, a lot of my crowd is people and Latinx people who also grew up with religion being, you know, stuffed down their throat and who also didn't fit in, who feel like aliens in their families, but also we're at odds with ourselves, you know? Like, I love my mom, but I can't, you know, tell her a lot of things. And I think a lot of people who come to my shows and things like that also feel that way.
That segment was produced by The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett, and that's our show for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. Join us back here tomorrow.